So first off, just looking out the window today, it looks beautiful outside, and I'm so sorry to have to keep all of you in here. This is where we have like microphones and speakers and things like that. So man, what a gorgeous weekend it has been, and I know the Lord has blessed us finally by cooling off the temperatures, and I'm so thankful for that. When we talk here, and especially in this series, when we talk here about God being real, and I think this is a critical question to ask in our culture. I think it's a critical question for Christians to ponder, because it's easy for us to like get in our lane, be around our kind of people, people that think the same way we do, and then not to even consider the questions that people have. Increasingly, I hear that people say, my question isn't necessarily about God, like I don't really know about that. My problem is with religion. And specifically, people will say, I have a problem with organized religion. Because religion, when it gets organized and it tends to become like all sorts of human and everything, and God might be out there, but the religion thing seems sort of messed up. And so that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about religion as opposed to faith, because they're not always the same thing. And specifically, I think the best way to do this is to go all the way back in the Bible and look at the religion that Jesus came to redeem. And specifically, that religion takes its form in the book of Leviticus. So Genesis is God's creation of the world and then the calling of his people. Exodus is when Moses is to lead the people out of Egypt, out of slavery, away from Pharaoh. But then in the book of Leviticus, we end up with the priestly manual. Now that the people are out of slavery, and obviously these years and years and years of this kind of abuse and persecution and everything that happened to them in slavery, they really don't know how to be human. And so it's really easy for the creator God who can do anything, it's really easy for God to take a slave out of Egypt. But how do you get that Egypt out of the slave, which you're going to hear me say a lot? How do you get that Egypt out of the slave after life has been stepping on you and stepping on you? How do you get rid of the bitterness? How do you get rid of the need for revenge? How do you get rid of the anger? How do you get rid of the fact that they haven't let you experience your faith to worship the way that you were always supposed to? How do you get rid of the fact that you have memories of that time when they took the firstborn baby boys and they murdered them in Egypt? Except for Moses, who escaped in a reed basket. How do you get that out of your heart and mind? It's going to taint you. It does. And so Moses' plan, God's plan that he gave to Moses was, here's the book of Leviticus, and we're going to start taking some baby steps, and we're going to put some rituals in, and we're going to come up with a religious pattern, a religious form, and it's going to start to teach the people about how to get rid of these problems. It's going to start to form them into a religious body. And again, none of the sacrifices necessarily like impress God. He's just wanting us to deal with our stuff. Leviticus chapter 1, let's look at like right at the beginning as it starts to talk about this. And by the way, if you've ever tried to read the Bible in a year or something like that from cover to cover, I know what it was like for you. I've done it several times, and sometimes I've read it out of order, like in a different kind of order than just Genesis to Revelation, but I've done it several times in my life, and I know what it was like. You read through Genesis, and you're like, okay, good, good, good. I'm hearing the primeval history and kind of creation of the world. Most of those stories were pretty good. Then you got to Exodus, and it's like, yeah, this is what it was like in slavery, and then they got out, and the parting of the Red Sea, that was a good part. And then you got to Leviticus. And if you read chapter 1 and you kept going, let me just say, well done, friend. Well done. Because it reads like what we're about to read. If the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, you are to offer a male without defect. Why? It's an innocent victim. It's taking your sins from you. So it needs to be something that's without blemish, that hasn't, whatever. I don't know what sheep experience, but let's just imagine they need to be innocent. You must present it at the entrance to the tent of meeting so that it will be acceptable to the Lord. You are to lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering. By the way, I've read every scholar out there, including Jewish rabbis. You can look back at all kinds of commentaries. Nobody knows why when you present the offering for your family, you have to lay your hand on it. Some conjecture says Maybe it's the transfer of guilt. But if you look at the wider context, it probably doesn't mean that. So we can get to some of these rituals, and we can't even tell you why. But they're so detail-oriented, and sometimes you're looking at this thinking, God, does it really matter, and like how you lay the hand and all? And God and Moses is making it very clear. Oh, cool. Thanks. Whose is this? All right, there you go. Uh-oh. But Moses is making it clear the details totally matter. They matter. God's taking you through baby steps. And just as a little aside, if any of our brothers, sisters here ever been through recovery, you know why this is important. If you've been through recovery, if you've been through a 12-step program, you know why the baby steps are so important, because you're kind of starting over in life and you're like, the habit took me over. And so now I need good habits. And what do? They say, if you want to win the day, you have to win the morning. It matters what you eat for breakfast. It matters what time you wake up. It matters if you go and exercise. This is the genius of the military. All you 18-year-olds that are so aloof and think you're so creative, you're the very ones that need the military. You need somebody to tell you, make your bed. Does it matter? It does. It does, because the genius is in the details. It's in taking care of your stuff. You're taking care of yourself. You're taking care of yourself. It continues. You lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering. It will be accepted on your behalf to make atonement for you. Let's go to verse 5. You are to slaughter the young bull before the Lord, and then Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood and splash it against the sides of the altar. We've got to try this sometime in here. I love it. I love it. Look, when that happens, you're going to pay attention, right? Maybe that's all it was. You're going to splash the sides of the altar with the blood at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And why is the tent of meeting important? One of the things Moses was doing is he's saying, you've got all this life and you came out of this life of chaos. Pharaoh wanted to set up a certain kind of world. And in setting up this world, he set up a world where in order to control the society and keep people safe and keep law and order, he used brutality. He used slavery to get things built. There was a certain way of ordering the world that Pharaoh did, that Egypt did. And part of what God is saying here is he's saying, we're going to reorder this thing. We're going to recreate this thing. In fact, the tent of meeting in this place especially, we're going to have a concretization of the ideal. We're going to take the ideal that God has in heaven and wants to set up on earth, and we're going to concretely start practicing it early. We're going to teach you how to deal with your shame, how to deal with your guilt. We're going to teach you how to deal with your joy, how to deal with your thanksgiving. And if you go through Leviticus 1 through 7, you'll notice that it's a lot of this repeated and repeated and repeated. And it's always at the tent of meeting, and these are the different sacrifices. And one thing that's neat about it, let's say you're dealing with guilt. Moses has a sacrifice for that. Let's say you're dealing with shame. Moses has a sacrifice for that. What if you didn't necessarily do anything wrong, but you also didn't do the right thing? We call that a sin of omission. A sin of commission is something you did. A sin of omission is the right thing that you should have done, but you didn't quite follow through. We have a sacrifice for that. Well, what about like joy? What about like after you have a wedding and you know everything was amazing? Like we have a sacrifice for that. Like when your Thanksgiving is just busting out of you, we have a ritual for that. And so Moses was teaching them all of these things in Leviticus 1 through 7. It's a lot of repetition. It's a lot of detail, but there's genius in the detail. He's trying to teach these slaves baby steps, how to get back into a relationship with God, and how to have a good relationship with their neighbors. Now, again, I don't know that God's necessarily like is so impressed with this stuff. I think he's impressed with them when they're humble enough to admit their guilt. I think the reason the aroma is pleasing to the Lord is his people are stepping up and they're saying, look, I made a mistake and I don't want it to be this way and I want my life to change. I think that's what's pleasing. It continues, you are to skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. The sons of Aaron, the priests, are to put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Next verse, verse 8. Then Aaron's sons, the priest, shall arrange the pieces, including the head and the fat on the wood that is burning on the altar. Kind of sounds like a Texas barbecue. That's why I love Leviticus. Here's another fun thing that happens in Leviticus later on. It talks about where all each of the pieces are supposed to go. Like, the priests are allowed to eat certain portions, and some of the portions the people might be allowed to eat, but then there's other portions that are specifically dedicated to the Lord. Nobody can eat them. And one of the places is where God says to Moses, make sure the people know this, but the fat, that is the Lord's. I love that because I love bacon. And I was at this barbecue place the other day and it had this gristly bacon burnt ends. And I'm like, that's what he means in Leviticus. God is kind of like a Texan. We like good fatty ribeyes. The fat is the Lord's. Now, again, it's a burnt offering, it's a food offering, and it's an aroma pleasing to the Lord. Does he love the aroma? Well, if he's like me, he loves the smell of barbecue. But maybe it's more about the action. Maybe it's more about what's pleasing is, oh, they're doing it. They're taking baby steps back. They're understanding guilt now. They're understanding shame. They're starting to understand sins of omission. Maybe I can get Egypt out of them. Their hearts are coming cleaner and cleaner and cleaner, and the society is becoming better and better and better. Another thing you'll notice, I said seven chapters. There's a whole pattern of sevens that happens in Leviticus. When I say the number seven, Christians think creation, creation. And so, yeah, this is a reordering of what Pharaoh messed up. Pharaoh had a way of ordering his world, his ideal world. And now Moses is saying, we're going to reorder this as well. In fact, even the priests, when they get ordained, they have to spend 7 days at the front of the tent of meeting, and then they can start doing their sacrifices on the eighth day. Kind of remind you of Easter. You know, we the early Christians used to still go to synagogue on Saturday. They'd still practice the Sabbath and go to synagogue. But early on Sunday, the eighth day, the mysterious eighth day, the resurrection day, that's when they would practice in private in homes, and that's when they would celebrate the resurrection. That's why we meet, traditionally, Christians meet early on Sunday morning, the eighth day. It's when God has started his recreation, his recreation. And the tabernacle was already starting to practice some of that in a way as well. I don't know about y'all, but I don't tend to get emotional over most TV, most media. My mom tells stories about how when I was 3 years old and she'd take me to the movies and she would have to walk herself into the hallway because it was getting too intense and I would just sit there eating popcorn when I was 3 years old. But the shows that get me, and you're going to find this terrible, they're the makeover shows. I love the makeover shows. And not always, but what I love is they all kind of start the same. I love people that want their life to be better. And I love people that can train people to do it. And I think this has everything to do with Leviticus. And now I'm going to prove it. When a makeover show starts, how does it always start? The makeover people, they show up by surprise at their home. They want to catch them off guard. And where is the person always? They're always in a recliner wearing sweatpants. Or they have holes in their shirt or holes in their socks, right? Not that there's anything wrong with sweatpants, but there sorta is. Because sometimes when you have holes in your socks or you're in your old sweatpants, sometimes it means you're not really taking care of yourself. You're not honoring yourself, let's put it that way. You're not honoring yourself. And what the makeover people do, the first thing they start with is the big black Glad bags. It's time to throw things away. And in some cases, it's kind of easy. In other cases, a little bit emotional. You get attached to these things. But they're trying to let you know, throw out the socks with holes in them. Let's get you some nice socks. Or they take you in the kitchen and they're like, how you start your day is the kind of day you're going to make. If you want to have a great day, have a great morning. So they say, this is how you cook some healthy meals. This is what breakfast is supposed to look like. This is why you start your day with exercise. Or you start your day with prayer. They start getting into the little details of life. Or sometimes they'll take the men who have beards and they say, you really need to trim that thing. So they take you to a barber.
teach you to keep your face clean, or they get your hair cut. In some cases, there's women who've never really learned how to do makeup, and they'll take them to a famous makeup artist, maybe in Hollywood, and give them a makeover, and when they see themselves or their family sees them, they all break down in tears because they haven't felt beautiful in so long. They haven't felt special in so long. And I'm moved by this because it's the simple little details. Like, for example, how you start your morning. Do you start it in the drive-thru? And then do you take the wrapper and do you throw it in the back seat? You can tell a lot about a person with what's on their floorboard. And what the makeover shows will do is they'll say, wait a minute, no. If you want to win the day, win the morning. Like, slow it down a little bit and make sure that you're ordering your life in ways that are actually healthy and productive. And for us too, that's what the Fat Friar Challenge is going to be. That's what it's been. Now, we're having our last weigh-in today, but we're going to share the results next week. And by the way, by next summer, I'm reasonably sure it won't be the Fat Friar Challenge. It's going to be like the Seriously Buff Pastor Challenge or something like that. I don't know. But it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun. And what's been so interesting for me is more the lens of really appreciating those people in your life who maybe share some hard truth with you, but they understand the genius is in the details. And they only share this with you because they love you and they believe in you. That's why we like good coaches. The good coaches are tough. They're tough. But they want you to be better. I thought about a story. This kind of came from Pastor Morgan in a weird way. But I started to think about Luka Doncic. I woke up this morning at 3:30 a.m. for no reason. I'm so dumb. I don't know why. As I was up and I was watching television, and I saw they did a replay of the Dallas Mavericks scrimmage game. They just played this, I guess, yesterday against Beijing. So it was like a Chinese national team, and they were playing. And I got to watch Luka Doncic, the first-round draft pick. He's the new hope for the Mavericks. He's the same height as Dirk. He can shoot like Dirk, and Dirk's about to retire. So Dirk gets to mentor Luka, and like, this is the big hope of Dallas. And you guys really need this to work out, because obviously my Rockets will win the championship, and the Astros are going for back-to-back World Series. So it's like, I know. I'm just going to be up here bragging all the time, but if Luka can hit that jumper like he did last night, I'm going to tell you what, there's a lot of hope up here. There's a lot of hope in North Texas. Now, this is my opinion. Luka's a European player. He's 6'10 or taller, just like Dirk, good shooter. I mean, there's a lot of similarities. Do you think he's ever gone to Dirk? And I think the answer is yes. And he said, we all have the same uniform. What kind of socks do you wear? And do you think Dirk said, I don't know. I just, when I get holes in them, I just send my wife to Target and she just picks up whatever. No. He's been playing professional basketball at the top level for 20 years. I guarantee you he cares what socks he puts on. I guarantee you he knows there's genius in the details. I guarantee you that if he just gets some run-of-the-mill Nike sock out of Target and puts it on, he's not going to be comfortable. Because Dirk knows if you're playing back-to-backs, you don't want blisters. He knows this stuff matters. The genius is in the details. And it's both for the masters of their trade, a former MVP and NBA All-Star, but it's also true for those in the recovery movement. Let's get back to basics. It's the same thing for those in the military who are going through basic training. Let's teach you from the ground level how to build the foundation so that you're going to be strong and capable, and you're going to succeed in life. That's what Leviticus is. It's the genius in the details that helps them recover from what they went through. In fact, on our trip, this is what reminded me, Pastor Morgan, throughout this whole adventure of us exercising and everything, got some new running shoes. And I'm like, that's really cool. He went to a specialty shop and got expensive running shoes. And then he said, but the thing I really love are these expensive socks. And I said, I know. Because once you try expensive socks, suddenly your feet don't sweat the same, and they keep you from getting, there's genius in this. It's why when I go to Germany, I always want to come back to the United States and yell at everybody. They have metal that doesn't rust there. The trains are always on time, and everything works. I come back here, and I'm like, why is everything from a dollar store in our country? Oh, okay, another subject, another time. Here's a religion quote. Our worship team asked me where I got this quote, and I said, well, I wrote it, so I guess I'm the one that quoted it. This is what I think religion is. Religion are rituals that elevate the mundane for an ordered life. Now, you could also say an ordered faith, but I don't think faith and life are different. I think faith and life go together. But you elevate the mundane, the details, so that you can order things. Like we as a church, how do we start worship? We opened up with some praise to God, then we moved into a time of confession. The Bible doesn't say that you have to have a public confession to have worship, but we do it. Why do we do it? We want to humble ourselves. We're the most affluent country in the world. We need to remind ourselves, though, that in God's order of things, we're not all that important. Then we might move into biblical readings. We had an Old Testament and a gospel. They're important around here to have both. Then we moved into the creed. Do you have to have the Nicene Creed to have worship? Lutherans don't answer because you think the answer is yes, and the answer is no. Jesus didn't even know the Nicene Creed. I assume he agrees with it. He embodies it. He is it. Like, he's like that second article. It's great that we connect with the history of the church by confessing the Nicene Creed, but that's a religious form that we choose. The Bible doesn't even know the Nicene Creed's out there. This came way after the Bible. But it's a form we choose. And I think we as a church, sometimes we got to meet together. We got to decide, what are we choosing to make our form of religion? But just make sure that we realize it's a way of practicing our faith, but it's not the same as our faith. What we do and the forms we do and how we dress and if we kneel or don't kneel at communion, none of that is God. And none of that is faith. Faith is a relationship with the Lord. It's a relationship that Jesus has established on your behalf, but it is a relationship with the Lord. Faith is not the same as our religious form. And when we're able to do that, we have more respect for our fellow Christians, and we're able to appreciate, you know, like the little things about them. And we might say, hey, at the end of the day, we want our kids to know the creed, so we're going to worship with it. Good. Good. But just know the difference between those things. Leviticus 9, this is one of my favorite parts of the chapters. You go through 1-7, you have all these details, and this is how you cut up, and this is where the thigh goes, and this is where the leg goes, and it's just crazy, and you're burning the sacrifices. And then in Leviticus 9, it tells what happens after the people did all the sacrifices for their guilt, their shame, for their sins of omission, for their joy, for their thanksgiving. It says that the people erupted in praise and thanksgiving to God. They erupted in praise and thanksgiving to God, and they all had joy in their lives. Let me remind you where they came from. It is possible for ordinary people, and these were ordinary people. They were not given education. They were not even given freedom. They had very little going for them. They were very ordinary. It is possible for ordinary people who are going through extraordinarily horrific things to experience and embody tremendous joy and thanksgiving. They had to worry all the time that just on a hillside, there could be another tribe that's coming in to conquer them. In fact, a lot of the Old Testament is about all these tribes that are trying to conquer them. They could have so much anxiety and fear, and I'm sure they had some of that. So much anxiety and fear that this is going to happen, that, you know, we are so protected, we can't even imagine what this is like. And yet, it is possible, because Leviticus 9, right at the end, it tells us that because of the Lord's connection with them and because of these sacrifices, it is possible for ordinary people, even facing tremendous persecution, can experience and embody tremendous joy and thanksgiving and gratitude in their lives. And Christians, that's your calling. That's your calling. Look at our gospel lesson for today. This is what I want to close with. In Mark chapter 9, Jesus is hanging out with his disciples. He's walking with them. And he's asked them, you know, who do people say that I am? And they're going through all that kind of stuff. And then finally, he's teaching them a little bit about what the church is supposed to be about. And he says, you know, the first is last, and the last will be first. And how do you think about yourselves? And then he asks his disciples, what were you guys arguing about on the road here? And nobody wanted to answer them. Because they were arguing about who gets to be first. They were arguing about who's the most important. They were arguing about who gets to be in the captain's chair. And what I want to warn you is, we as Christians, We need to take Jesus' words as our gospel. Because in God's ordering of the world, we don't have the chance. We're not given the chance to put ourselves first. Because what does Jesus say right before that point? He tells them right before that, the Son of Man has come here to suffer and to die, and after 3 days he will rise. The Son of Man, this is the gospel. This is what it means to be a Christian. The gospel is the Son of Man has taken all the suffering of the world. He has given his life, but he has risen for you. And with that becomes a new possibility, a new foundation for what life can be. And because he's done this, now why are you guys arguing about who's first place? Who gets the first chair? Not in this reordering of creation. The first will be last and the last will be first. He's calling us to sacrifice as he sacrificed for us. That's the gospel in action in our lives. And so we just need to make sure that that becomes what we're doing. That's what all this is about. That's how when we know God is real, people are going to see it in all of us. We're going to continue next week with our series. We'll continue kind of making our way through. I want us to really look at the person of Jesus. I want us to look at the scriptures. Are they reliable? Here's the thing with me. Why do I take on Leviticus? I think there's a lot of Christians that stay in the easy parts. And when I was in confirmation class and I had a question, and it was a difficult question, my pastor said, you just need to have faith about that. And I said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. I want to get in the scriptures. I want to be faced with everything that's in there. If we're throwing blood on the altar, I want to know why. And so it's become a big part of my ministry. We're not going to shy away from Leviticus here. We're going to take it for what it is, and we're going to see the Lord speaking the whole way, and we're also going to appreciate how far he's taken us away from that slavery into his freedom. Let me invite our ushers forward at this time as we take our offering.